The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
And a very good afternoon to you. It's Brenda Donoghue. I'm here today. I would love your company, your thoughts, of course, on 51551. Or you can email me here, ray@rte.ie. So how are we all today? What are we up to? I went for a little walk at lunchtime, went round the building. It's a very pleasant day out there. Lovely breeze, nice little bit of sunshine. And we have plenty of sunshine on the show today because Victoria Smurfit is in. She's in for a catch-up. And we have live music from Amy. Now, I have a quick question for you. It doesn't include you, Harry. Harry's on sound up there. But here's my question. Would you wear a second-hand wedding dress? So we know the wedding season is in full swing at the minute. And I read a very interesting piece in The Telegraph today about how wearing second-hand wedding dresses have become really popular with brides, especially since a lot of women wear two dresses, one for the ceremony and one for the reception. Now, that's actually a new one on me because in my day, you did wear two dresses, but it was kind of a going away outfit. Do you remember you'd do the arch, you'd have a suit, and you'd go under the arch. Anyway, that was my day. But I know myself when I walk around Nace and looking at the different charity shops, you walk past the charity shops and they're the most beautiful wedding dresses in the windows, and they're often not just the size 10. You get a good variety there of style and shape. So they're lovely secondhand wedding dresses. And I want to know, are you considering wearing a secondhand wedding dress, or have you already worn one on your big day? Of course, the other side of it is, would you sell your own wedding dress? What did you do with your one? I know my one is in the back of a wardrobe somewhere. It was like a two-piece, it had a gold satin skirt, but it had a lovely kind of white cream bodice with lovely gold beading in it. And somebody went and spilled pink champagne over it. And I brought it down to that very posh cleaners on Baggot Street and I paid a load of money, but it still hasn't come out. But it's there. I haven't got rid of my wedding dress. And that's actually, I thought I was married 21 years, but I'm actually married 22 years. So anyway, do you have any suggestions about what to do with an old wedding dress? How do you feel about wearing a second one? Give us a shout, ray@rte.ie or 51551. Now, you know, weddings can be very noisy affairs, and so too can neighbours. Do you have a noisy neighbour? Well, it can't be that bad, because an award-winning Scottish bagpiper has been called a public nuisance for practising in his garden in Sunderland in England. Let's have a listen what it'd be like. You're out sunbathing, you're reading your book, the birds are there tweeting, and then suddenly... Ah, come on, to be fair, he only plays twice a week. Anyway, spare a thought for poor Niamh in the office. She lives next door to a creche and she hears the kids playing all day and the parents dropping them off really early in the morning and then very loudly saying, "Have the best day, darling. I miss you. I love you." And all it's... Anyway, another thing that's quite noisy with neighbours, not that I've experienced it myself, but noisy sex is another issue people have. But how do you broach the topic? A barking dog is one thing and you can have an honest chat about that. But how do you knock on the door and say, "Hello, Mary and Sean, how are you getting on? Listen, you wouldn't mind keeping it down in there. Tell me and send me your stories, please." I thought I had a clip of the noisy neighbours having sex. No, I don't have that. Anyway, send me your stories of noisy neighbours to ray@rte.ie or 51551. And I want to move on to something just a little more serious, because if you remember on Monday, we spoke to Donna Vuma and she is a mum with three kids living in direct provision. And she'd set up a backpack initiative where she'd drop off points around the country and you could donate pencils, rubbers, copies, vouchers for children who are in direct provision and are struggling to go back to school. And it was really interesting. But I see that the Labour Party today is calling for a ban on school voluntary contributions, which it says are fees in disguise. And now I want to hear from parents on this one. What is the situation in your own child's school? How much of a voluntary contribution are you asked to give? I think the thing about voluntary contributions is you kind of try and tick the boxes of the books, the expenses, the shoes, the tracksuits, and then you forget about them and then suddenly there's the voluntary contribution, or you know it's coming and you're kind of all worked up about where am I going to get the extra cash, because sometimes parents can feel pressurised to hand over the cash every year. And I suppose, why is that? And I think parents worry that if they don't give the voluntary contribution, that their child is going to be treated differently, although I don't really believe that that happens, but they do worry about it. Or if they don't pay up, they won't have as much say in how the school is actually run. So tell me, what is your experience of this? And is it actually okay to ask struggling parents for extra money like this? Now, I will say, bear in mind that the teachers, the principals, they're all doing their best for the children, and the extra funds are needed to help run a school. So give me your thoughts on 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Brenda, I hired my wedding dress 49 years ago, said Deirdre. I made twin christening outfits out of my wedding dress. Oh, that's lovely. Something I can pass down. Great idea. My mum made my daughter's communion dress out of a wedding dress. I see we're getting a lot of uses there. Brenda, the worst second-hand wedding dresses are the ones advertised as never worn. Oh, yeah. Why? I wouldn't feel right wearing one of those, said Mary in Malahide. We'll keep all those texts coming in. 51551. Before I play a piece of music, I'm going to leave you with this. It's just a little story to haunt you forever with. There is a woman, and she does not work in RTE. I will say that again. She does not work in RTE, but she boiled her dirty knickers in a hotel kettle when she didn't have a clean pair. And what's she going to do? She went and shared the tip on Facebook, and the post, needless to say, went viral. People were very quick to point out that there are a number of reasons why you shouldn't boil your underwear in a kettle. It leaves bacteria inside the kettle. Ah, here, I can't read this. Which the person, after, you'd probably end up drinking, and it doesn't even clean the pants properly. On social media, lots of users commented, vowing that they would never make a cup of tea in a hotel room again. So if you work in a hotel, what is the worst thing you have found in a hotel room, whether it's a strange object or a messy guest? This is definitely not an isolated incident. I know myself, I worked in a hotel in the Isle of Man. Actually, I will not tell that story, but I want your stories. I cannot tell that story. It's just so bad. But if you have hotel stories, 51551, we would love to hear them. Hi, Brenda. My sister sold her wedding dress when I was on my honeymoon and bought two single beds and all the extras for them, said Kate. Well done, Kate. Do you know what? We'll take a piece of music. We'll just think about that hotel and the kettle and all that. Cleaned Bandit featuring Jess Glynn. Here we go. That's Clean Bandit there, Rather Be, featuring Jess Glynn. I hope that got you bopping. Well, you're certainly exercised over the voluntary contributions. I'll go through some of your texts now. It's €250 for our daughter in secondary school. It shouldn't exist, but does the secondary schools are hugely underfunded by the state? It's a huge bill on top of everything else. Luckily, our two other kids are still in national school. Brenda, my friend told the school she wouldn't pay the voluntary contribution as she's paying too much in grinds. She never paid it and heard nothing further about it. The school, it's €50. It's called a family contribution. I contacted the local VEC and asked if it's legal, as they've not mentioned it's a voluntary contribution. That's an interesting twist of words. Very heavy one here. Brenda, schools say it's voluntary, but send letter after letter to struggling parents about their voluntary contributions. This is a form of bullying, and I thought schools were to discourage the action of bullying, says S. You see, I think it's hard. Schools are genuinely only doing their best. If you're a teacher or a principal and you've got a take on this, we'd love to hear from you too. 51551. Teachers don't have access to the details of those who have not paid the voluntary contribution. That's good to know. So hence they can't form an opinion whether they would like to or not. But if they don't know, then it makes no difference. Let me see. I'll just scroll down here. The word voluntary parents, the word is voluntary. Parents just have to refuse to pay it. It's all about shaming parents into coming across with their hand, their hard-earned cash. Shameful. My son's school used to ask for a voluntary donation and then distributed a list of families who hadn't donated. Goodness. I objected, as it was so unethical, but was met with a lot of objections from the Board of Management. But I persisted and they stopped the list. I was later elected school board and then realised just how much money the school had in their accounts. Voluntary contribution. Every away match that a school may have requires a bus. Hire a bus for any distance costs an average €200. Debating, gas, GAA, soccer, rugby, visit to a historic, geographical or artistic venue. They all cost a lot of money. So add up how many day trips for various reasons your child took in a year and compare to the voluntary contribution. Guest speakers in school may require a payment, or a workshop for study, mental health, etc. require payment. Schools run on tight, reduced grants from the Department of Education and Skills, so it's easier to pay one-off fee or pay than ask your child to pay each time, said Rory in Skerries. And they keep coming in. And of course, we have a lot on the wedding dresses and the noisy neighbours. We'll get to them all. 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. We'll take a break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
And it's Brenda here until 4:30 today. I'm now joined on the line by Grace Healy, and she is a mother from Cork and a nurse. And she posted an amazing post on Facebook, and it's very quickly getting a lot of attention. She is on the line. And Grace, you've had a very bad month. How are you?
Not too bad. I'm recovering slowly, but we're getting there.
Okay, well, look, first of all, tell me a little bit about your son, David. How old is he?
So he's 2.5. He's a firecracker, really. He's a fine, active child. But this day in particular, he was having a fantastic day running around the garden, having a great time altogether. And happened to pick up the bag of peanuts and started, you know, scoffing them in his mouth for all the world, really. He was stuffing them in and stuffing them in. And I said, oh, my goodness, he can't eat a bag of peanuts. Child can't be walking around with a bag of peanuts, you know. And
if it's there, they'll take it.
Well, see, that's the thing. He found it, you know. Yeah. But, I mean, that's it. They can take anything, I suppose, children.
Yeah.
They'll pick anything up and put it into their mouth, won't they, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
but you can't turn your back. Peanuts. Yeah, he's eating the peanuts.
So he took the bag of peanuts and somebody tried to take it off him and he wouldn't give them away. So then I tried. I said, oh, will you give mommy the bag of peanuts, sweetie, and I'll give you some chocolate, you know, and to try and like soften the blow of me taking the bag, because I was already kind of worried that he might cry, you know, with a mouthful of peanuts if I took the bag off him. So I tried to take the bag and he tried to cry. And so then, you know, the way children cry, they take these massive gasps.
Yeah.
Like these breaths, he kind of went to cry and he inhaled the whole lot. So a full mouthful of peanuts into his mouth, yeah. Mm. And so I said, immediately I said, oh my God, he's choking. So I turned him over, gave him 5 back flaps and I got a load of peanuts out on the floor because my sister-in-law was there and she was like, oh look, you've got them, they're there now, you got them out. But when I turned him around then, he was silent and he was complete. His colour was going grey and his lips were turning blue at that point. And so I just told my husband, I said, ring 999. I said, we need an ambulance. He's choking. So I just continued then to do another 5 back slaps, turn it back over, still nothing. And another 5 back slaps, nothing. I think I maybe did another 5. And then after that, I started some chest thrusts. They're like chest compressions on a child, kind of 2 fingers on the sternum. So tried to do a couple of chest compressions on him to see if that would, you know, dislodge them, and nothing. And so I don't know how long. It was 3 minutes. Well, it was 2 minutes 58 seconds was the 999 log call, because we checked back to see how long he was, you know, out of. We were worried about, you know, his brain. So we were worried about how long he was, you know, talking for. So we looked back and it was 2 minutes 58 seconds.
And
so,
what was going through your head, Grace, as... I presume you were in panic mode, obviously.
I was, yeah, most certainly. I thought he was going to die, I suppose, really. I mean, my husband came back in at one point and said, do we still need the ambulance? He was on the phone, you know. And I remember saying to him, this child will be dead in about a minute and a half if I don't get this out of his airway. And my poor other son, who was there at the time with me, heard it, and sure, the poor child broke down, going, "Oh my God, I don't want David to die! I don't want David to die!" It was a terrible situation. Really, it was a nightmare. It was like stuff of nightmares, actually. So I continued on my CPR, and nothing was working. And then he kind of went limp. So all along, he was kind of squirming and moving. You know, like I felt him move, and then after one of the back slaps, I just felt him go limp. And I said, "Oh no, he's gone. This is it. This is it. He's gone, completely gone now." I said, "There's no coming back from this." And I just thought to myself, "Look, it's not coming out. I'll just try and push it down." So I just blocked his nose and gave him two breaths into his mouth. And almost immediately, the oxygen started returning, you know, to his body. He had, like, his lips became kind of pink again. And he, you know, was looking around dazed. So I couldn't believe it. So I literally said to my husband, "Quick, run! We're running into Kerry General Hospital. It's about 15 minutes from their house." So I said, "Quickly, get into the car now." And we brought him in. So I kept him in the front seat. I was just kind of like making sure his airway was, you know, open and maintained, and got into A&E. And then from there,
Grace, can I stop you there for a minute? Because when you're telling me all this, I'm thinking, if that was me. All right. Besides, obviously, the panic, and I know you get strength from nowhere in these kind of circumstances. But your training as a nurse, you're a nurse, is that right?
Yeah.
So at least you had that background, you had that knowledge. You probably went into automatic.
I did somewhat, definitely go into. You just have to suck it up now, cough on. I remember kind of thinking, get on with it now, because nobody else here is going to be able to help your child. You know, I just kind of remember thinking, I'm lucky with my work, you know, like, in fairness, my employer are great. They're all, you know, you always keep up your training and things. And I had done kind of like an anaphylaxis training. So it was kind of fresh enough in my head anyway, you know, the CPR. So I was very grateful for that, you know. But you do, we definitely feel, I remember vividly actually thinking, in all my training, I cannot believe that I'm here now doing CPR on my son. I remember thinking that.
And so you went to Kerry General Hospital, and so the penis had obviously gone down into his lungs then.
Yeah, but when we got there, he kind of perked up and he was kind of running around, and we had an x-ray, and the x-ray didn't show anything up, and, you know, there was no penis on the x-ray, which they would have been hard to see anyway. So they were like, "Look, you know, he might be fine. Maybe they're not in there," you know, they were saying. And then a pediatric doctor came and listened to him, and he heard reduced sounds in his left lung. So he was like, "Oh, I'm a bit concerned that I don't like the sound of his lung." And at this point, then David himself started dipping. You know, he wasn't running around. He was finding it hard to breathe then himself. And after a couple of kind of rounds of these nebulizers, they gave him this nebulizer, which he thought might clear his lung. And when he listened again, it didn't clear his lung. So he said, "I think for sure now we can be certain that there is penis in there." Now, one, they thought, obviously, they didn't obviously think that there was four. So they rang Cork and they said, "Look, we have a sick boy here. We think he's aspirated some peanuts. He's, you know, swallowed some peanuts in his lungs. What, will you take him in Cork?" And Cork said, "No, that it's a bit more serious, that he'll need to go to Crumlin or Temple Street." So then they were trying to organise us getting up to Temple Street. So we went in an ambulance. They were fabulous, the paramedics. They took us up in about 2 hours flat. We made it from Kerry to Crumlin. And from there, really, once we arrived, he was a very sick child, really, because I remember saying to the nurses up there, who were great now, and they really listened to me. Like I said, "This boy is a ticking time bomb." I said, "We can't sit in him. We don't have time to spare." You know, I was like, "I really want him to get to surgery now." I was like, "I'm really concerned for him," because he was absolutely very unstable at that point. And they did a chest x-ray, and the chest x-ray showed complete blockage to his left lung. There was no entry at all in his left lung. So after seeing the x-ray, everyone moved very quickly. In fairness, the teams were amazing. They moved really, really quickly, and he was brought down to theatre. The theatre itself was a very risky procedure. You know, his oxygen saturation levels dipped an awful lot during the procedure, and we were told that by the consultant anaesthetist and by the consultant ENT surgeon, you know, that it was a very difficult. He told us when he came into ICU afterwards, Mr. Russell, he said that in his 23 years, it was, you know, hands down the most difficult case, and that we have a very lucky boy still to be here alive today. He said he's just so lucky.
Isn't it hard to believe that a couple of weeks ago that you were all hanging out playing in a garden and there you are talking to a consultant saying your son is lucky to be alive? It's, I have to say, it's every parent's worst nightmare, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I look back and I say, was that actually our life? You know, were we there? Did that really happen? You know, it was like something from a dream, because the day was so beautiful in Kerry. The weather was amazing. I brought him into Amy in a swimming nappy and a t-shirt. Yeah. He didn't even have shoes on him. We were out splashing with water. It was almost too good to be true. It was just such a beautiful day we were having with our family.
Okay, the main question is, how is he now?
So now he's doing really well. He lost a lot of muscle, obviously, because he was on a ventilator for so long. So he's lost muscle. So we're just working up and building up some muscles and doing some physio exercises and things. And he will have to go back for a repeat procedure in about a year's time. But he's doing really well. And he's had no brain impairment, like, which we're all just amazed by.
That's great news. I
couldn't believe it, because there was one time where we were just a little bit concerned about his brain activity, you know. And I was heartbroken, for him to go through so much, you know, to have like two surgeries and all the obstacles thrown at him. And I thought, if we get him through all that and for him then to come out, you know, impaired, I'd be devastated if we'd deal with it. But I was like, oh, you know, like, it would be such a sad outcome. But he's perfect, and brain-wise.
Grace, you put a post up on Facebook, and that's what drew our attention to this. And it wasn't so much you wanted to share and tell everybody the story. You have a very strong message that you want to say now that you've had, I suppose, a little bit of time to maybe reflect on everything that's happened to you over the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what your key message is?
I think everybody needs to know CPR. Like, David would not have made it to Crumlin or even to Kerry General Hospital if I hadn't been there. And that is not to say I'm amazing. I'm not. It was the CPR that saved him. Like, everybody needs to know CPR. Even if you don't have children, you know, you could be walking down the street and you just don't know. I just think it gives people time. You get a chance. Where if you're there with no CPR training, you have to wait until, you know, first responders arrive. You could lose minutes. Mm. Minutes and minutes go by. You know, you don't really stand much of a chance, whereas if you're there and you can get in, start your compressions or do whatever you have to do, you really do stand a good chance of surviving. And children, like, if it's not a peanut, it could be anything. You know what I mean?
Listen. I know, and I'm sure we'll get many people texting and saying with their own stories of things that have happened and things that children have put into their mouth or drank, whether, you know, it's bleach or whatever, you know, they just do anything like that. But I'm thinking of him recovering and you're all up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Was there something he did or something he said that you said, he's back, we have him back, we have David, you know, in full flight again?
Well, it wasn't exposed till about about a day off the ventilator, I'd say, because he was extremely heavily sedated, you know, so he was very groggy and so he wasn't really saying much. And the first thing he said he wanted ice cream, and I was like, oh, look, ice cream. He was looking for
ice cream. He's a man, the grub.
Exactly, he looked for ice cream. We're like, that's a really good sign. We're like, that is fantastic that he looked for the ice cream, you know. And he said, he looked at his dad and he said, I'm coming with you. And we were like, yeah, that's David, because that's what he always says, I'm coming with you. You know, he doesn't ever want to be left out, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
And he always wants to go with daddy and everything. And we were just so thrilled. But there was a couple of days, you know, watching everything and saying, oh God, is he going to be okay? But he slowly came around. It was very slow because he was on a weaning plan off all the morphine and off all the strong, you know, sedation medication that he was on. But I have to say now, like, he's perfect brain-wise.
Yeah, we text in here, my 10-year-old never stops putting things in his mouth. I mean, it's such a common thing.
Yeah.
And how are you yourself, Grace, after it all? I mean, I'm sure it's been some roller coaster.
Oh, you know, it's how the actual post came off is that every night I go to bed, I can't get the colour, you know, the image of him out of my head down in Kerry when I was doing the CPR, that colour, I just can't get that picture out of my head. So I said, you know what, now it might be helpful if I write it down. So then when I had it wrote down, that's how the post came out. I said, you know, I should probably share this because it might help somebody. So I just every night think about it, but I'm so grateful that people are sharing it, and the amount of people who have commented that, oh, I'm going to book a CPR class now, I'm going to definitely do a CPR class. You know, I'm just, it's incredible the amount of people that have shared it and have said we're going to do it. And not even do a CPR class, to keep yourself updated. So if you do it just once a year, you know, even do something online, look online and just kind of refresh it in your head, you know.
Mm.
It will definitely stand to you.
Absolutely. Well, look, all I can say is we wish you and your family the best. We wish David a really buoyant, speedy recovery, that he comes back mm-hmm. and he's that firecracker that you love. And I think your warning about no peanuts near kids is big.
And I definitely think that's a big thing for me as well. Peanuts are absolutely, they're so damaging to the lining of the lungs. So obviously, we didn't know that. We were told he would have been better off falling Lego or money, anything. But peanuts, they are just one of the worst things you could swallow, peanut and batteries. So keep them out. Any batteries and any peanuts away from small children. Any parties where there's children around, get them out of sight. Just don't have them near. If you will have to introduce peanuts to kids, which they're trying to encourage these days now.
Just in terms
allergies
and that, yeah.
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 Give them peanut butter. Give them anything with a peanut in it, but don't give them the actual peanuts themselves.
We have be careful with lollipops on sticks.
Yeah,
when our
deadly.
Son was little, the lollipop came off the stick and he started mm-hmm. to choke. We rang the ambulance, but my husband somehow got it up. We were told to bring him to casualty to make sure there was no throat damage, and thankfully he was fine, said Bernadette.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting an awful lot of people saying thank you for sharing that message. But it's because it's not easy to talk about something like that and to see your son like that and go through what you and the family have gone through.
Mm-hmm. It was hell, I must say now. But I mean, everybody in Crumlin are just, they're just amazing. They're absolutely incredible. We're going to, there's so many ideas now that we have for fundraising.
Oh, you'll be back on to me, Grace, won't you?
Oh, I will. That's what I said. I said I'll be back on now because we have so many. We're going to try and do some fundraising revolving it around CPR so that we can get between the CPR and the Crumlin, do good all round. You know,
all right.
Clean parents off, but everything else.
Grace, it's really good to hear David as well. It is great to talk to you. What a great message. Know your CPR. Think about
Absolutely.
Doing a course. Do it quickly. You never mm-hmm. know when. And good luck to you all. I hope you get to enjoy the rest of the summer. And I'm delighted, we're all delighted to hear in the office here that David's doing well. Thanks a million for talking
to
us.
Thank
Appreciate
you. Take
that.
Care.
Thanks, Grace.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Well, it's Brenda here. We're doing a bit of jumping back and forward to all the different topics we are talking about today, and we are talking about wedding dresses and lots of texts in on secondhand wedding dresses. Yes, I got my wedding dress in Oxfam. Wonderful service. Afterwards, I cleaned it and returned it to Oxfam for resale, said Angela. I'm very happily married 15 years this Valentine's Day. Still have my wedding dress in my wardrobe in hopes that maybe one of my four daughters will someday wear it. I won't hold my breath as all I ever hear is, Mam, I'm never getting married. Anyway, Laura Cunningham, editor of Confetti magazine and author of The Wedding Planner, joins us to discuss the big trends in weddings. How are you, Laura?
Hi, Brenda. How are you?
I'm very good. So secondhand wedding dresses, is this becoming much more popular?
It is, yeah. I mean, people passing them on. Obviously, with the whole sustainability movement, it's become even more popular in the last couple of years. But there's been lots of websites that you can go on and kind of sell your wedding dress after the fact for a good few years now.
And we'd one or two texts in that were saying, you know, if you get a secondhand wedding dress, you're kind of wondering why is it there in the first place, especially if it says never worn. So are you taking that karma, that negative energy, that stigma, and bringing it into your wedding, into your life, into your relationship? What do you say to that?
I know. And I mean, obviously, like for people who are holding on to their wedding dresses for sentimental value, the second it becomes not sentimental, they want it out of their house and they want it sold. So I'm sure there is a bit of that going on, all right? I think it's best just not to ask where it came from, probably, so you don't have to think about that stuff. But I think, you know, superstition aside, maybe it has a beautiful story attached to it, and maybe you're just adding another one onto it, and then you'll pass it on again. And, you know, try and take your kind of the positive slant on the history that the dress might have.
Okay, so would you recommend that people sell their wedding dresses?
Look, absolutely personally, I would sell it. I'm not married though, so I can't really say.
Yeah.
I think if you're lucky enough and privileged enough to be able to keep something that is, you know, very expensive as a keepsake, then that's wonderful, and you know, more power to you. But this idea that your children are going to wear it after you, they don't want to wear your wedding dress. They definitely don't. You didn't want to wear your mother's. They're probably not going to wear it. So, I mean, keeping it and maybe altering it into something else.
Yeah, we've a lot of shorter dress gowns, or something.
Communion dresses. Again, kids are just, like, they're not really wearing the traditional kind of white now a lot of the time for christening. So, you know, you're keeping it based on something that may never happen. But, you know, like I say, if it means a lot to you and you can afford to keep it, then by all means do.
Okay, so Laura, you know all things weddings.
Oh, I do.
I haven't been to a wedding in ages. I wish somebody would invite me because I love a good wedding.
And you're like me, you're kind of out the other end of them now. I went through years there where, you know, you're at that certain age, and I went to 13 of them in 1 year, but I'm very late 30s now, should we say, so they're starting to thin out.
I know, yeah, and they're great fun. They're just
they're
a
great,
bit expensive.
Yeah, I'm going to this weekend.
You know, what is going on with this whole 2-day wedding thing where you have the big day? Like, I don't mean to be boring, but when I got married, you had the big day. And then if people were hanging around afterwards, they had a few drinks and it was normally very relaxed. But now it's like a second wedding on day two with barbecues and everything. So what is going on? Are people just gone mad?
They are. I suppose they just want to extend it a little. And I suppose for the last few years, people have been having something maybe in their house the day after. They might have a barbecue or more likely their parents' house. But then the work attached to that is huge, and you're probably exhausted the day after your wedding day. So now a lot of people are splashing out. They're having the 2 days, day two at the same venue, maybe
very
a barbecue,
expensive.
A bit of live music. It is very expensive, but I am told more often than not that people really, really loved the second day of their wedding.
Yes.
Maybe not more than the day before, but the pressure was off and they were able to hang out with their friends and just kind of take in everything that happened the day before without everyone vanishing, you know? Because they've put so much thought and effort into this one day and then it's gone before you know it. So I think if you can have a second day, it's such a good idea.
And church versus non-religious ceremonies. Well, mm-hmm. Have we any figures or statistics on that? Because just anecdotally, it just seems less and less people are getting married in churches.
It is, yeah. It's around 50-50. So we released our book, The Wedding Planner, this year. So we did a huge survey. And, you know, out of the hundreds of brides and grooms that we interviewed, it was slightly less than half are choosing to get married in a church now. So the scales have kind of tipped in that way. Now, that's not necessarily an indication of whether people are religious or not. It's just that the beautiful big wedding venues in Ireland now have beautiful ceremony spaces. And I think just the fact that weddings are a lot more kind of freeform and contemporary now, people want to get married on the lawn, or they want to get married in a barn, or, you know, on a cliff, or on the seafront, or somewhere really kind of epic. So it's not necessarily, you know, an indication of people becoming less religious, although I'm sure that's, you know, a large part of it as well.
Yeah. So your major trend for 2019, and bear in mind our own Catherine Thomas will be walking up the aisle
very shortly.
Everybody's very excited to see your dress and everything.
I can't wait.
So, with all that in mind, what are the trends for a young couple getting married in 2019?
I think the overarching trend for everything, and this applies to all elements of the day, is just a lack of formality. Everything's a little bit more casual and a little bit more personal to the couple themselves. So it used to be the thing that you'd get married in your local church and then you'd have the reception at, you know, the hotel that you spent years doing everything else in as you grew up. But now people are kind of having the type of party they'd like to go to, I guess, as opposed to one that their parents might throw. So they're more casual venues. Food tends to be a little bit more casual, a bit more, you know, there's a lot more barbecues and kind of, you know, like gourmet barbecues, like really nice stuff. And
burgers.
Yes. But the likes of antipasti and, you know, grazing tables, that kind of thing. Family-style eating as opposed to beef and salmon. Even the way people are dressing is getting a little more casual in terms of the wedding party.
The bridesmaids aren't all matched up.
What? No, it's less matchy-matchy now,
no.
Thank God. It might be one colour and they all choose their own dress in the same colour, or even not even the same colour, maybe just tonally the same kind of hue.
Yeah.
Bridesmaids are wearing jumpsuits. The groomsmen are wearing, you know, maybe just a tweed waistcoat and chinos at certain kind of super casual summer weddings.
Sorry, I can't take chinos at a wedding. Are you serious?
Well,
I'm
now
going to get my high horse here. Never.
Yeah, guests are wearing them more and more as well now. You don't necessarily have to wear a suit to a wedding. If you wear like a really neat shirt, a pair of chinos and a pair of boots, it's kind of more than acceptable now.
Oh,
depending on the venue,
there's
of course.
Because it's nice to get dressed up and doll yourself up. Wear a pair of chinos to it. Never.
Unless you're 13 in a year.
Before I let you go, just give us that little shock figure of what is the average cost of a wedding in Ireland now. Just like close my eyes. And
it's 27,500, and that's not including the honeymoon. And to be honest with you, if you're talking about your big wedding in one of the top 20 venues, 2 days, the amazing photographer, you're not going to get out of that for under maybe 35, 40.
And you're going to wear a pair of chinos.
Well, that's all you can afford after buying everything.
Listen, Laura, you and me could talk all day. It is lovely to catch up. That's Laura Cunningham there.
Thank you so much for
having me. Yeah, editor of Confetti magazine. And of course, we might have a little chat about Catherine's dress and we'll go over the style and is it on trend and all that. I'm sure she will look absolutely beautiful.
Oh, she'll be a vision, no doubt.
Absolute vision. Anyway, it's great to talk to you. Keep your texts coming in, 51551ray@rte.ie. After the break, I am going to be talking to a very interesting young woman, a disability activist, Niamh Ní Herbert.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, I am now joined by disability activist Niamh Ní Herbert, who is here to talk about living with a rare disease, Friedreich's ataxia, and her ambition is to secure treatment funding even before a treatment is found.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Niamh.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Did I say it right? Ní Herbert?
Herbert, yeah.
Nearly there, nearly there. Come here, you were telling me before, just during the break there, we could be distantly related.
Distantly, yeah.
That's great. What's the connection?
I think it's one of my dad's cousins is somehow related
to my dad.
Something, yeah.
Anyway, nice to meet you, cuz. Straight away. Listen, first of all, I've read a little bit about you, but can you tell us exactly what your condition is? What is ataxia?
Yeah. So Friedreich's ataxia is, I find it really hard to sum it all up, but it's a very rare condition. There's about 200 people in Ireland living with it. It's a neuromuscular condition that affects the nerves and muscles, and it's progressive, so everything degenerates over time and it affects everything. You know, 2 years ago I was walking independently, but now I rely on a wheelchair, and I have cardiac issues, scoliosis, everything you can imagine along with it. But Friedreich's ataxia doesn't impact the mind, the cognitive ability.
The mind is strong.
Definitely
bright and sparky. And can I ask, how old are you?
I'm 22.
22. And how rare is it now? Can you give me an idea how many people would have it in the country, do you think?
Yeah, in the country, it's less than 200.
Less than 200, so it's pretty...
Yeah, it's pretty rare, yeah.
And is it genetic?
It is, hereditary.
Hereditary,
so,
yeah.
Both my mum and dad were carriers of the defective gene, and so there was a 1 in 4 chance that I would be born with FA. But like before, my brother and I were diagnosed with FA, there was no previous incidents of it in the family, so kind of shell-shocked.
I can imagine. And very difficult for mum and dad, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. And so you have a brother.
Mm-hmm.
How old is he? And tell me a little bit about him.
He is 21. We're a year and a bit apart.
Irish twins.
Yeah, Irish twins. Yeah. That's it. His name is Keane, and we're vastly different people. Yeah, I've tried to coax him on board to my campaign, but he's not one for all the photos and going on radio and stuff, so...
Yeah, so you're the one blazing the trail, and he's a little bit of the inspiration behind it. Have I got it nailed? Excellent. So when did you first notice the symptoms of it, or how do they manifest themselves?
So I was actually always quite an active child. I did brownies, scouts, dancing, loads of different sports. And I kind of got to a stage where I was finding it quite hard to keep up with everyone else. And it wasn't really clear why. And so my mum brought me to my GP where they noticed a curve in my spine. And when the doctor said that to me, I remember thinking, oh, like, you know, bad news, but it's not the end of the world. But I remember my mum started crying and it didn't really make sense to me, but she had realised back then what it was, because my brother had been diagnosed years before me.
Okay. But, your poor mum. And poor, I mean, you know, just at that moment and the realisation. And so it was kind of not keeping up with people, it was the curvature of the spine.
Yeah.
And then, so you're 22 now, so how quickly did it go to you needing to have a wheelchair? Or was that something that you were, say, I suppose not happy to do, but resisted.
Yeah, I was very stubborn to not getting a wheelchair. But it's been about 10 years since then, and I only started using a wheelchair 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've found since then actually using a wheelchair gives me a lot more independence than, you know, when I insisted walking around and falling over all the time. So.
And the thing is, you have a very interesting campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But I want you to try and explain what it is to people and what you're thinking. Because, you know, when we hear somebody with cystic fibrosis and there's a drug out there and they can't access it and there's no mm-hmm. funding, and then they get funding and it's all a bit of a journey, that's all part of your story.
Yeah.
So I'm going to let you explain what your campaign is and why you're so, I suppose, it means so much to you.
Yeah, so a few months ago, I was kind of struck by the thought that, like, there currently is no cure or treatment. But when it does come to the point that there is, we're going to have to campaign for who knows how long, years on end, to be able to avail of the treatment, even though it's on the market, because the HSE and the NCPE won't provide funds for it. And
this is based on kind of history, looking at, you know, the mm-hmm. cervical cancer drugs, cystic fibrosis. Funding has come true, but it's taken
a lot of time.
And a big campaign.
Yeah, and the reason why I'm so kind of caught up in the time is that if you think about it, 2 years ago, I walked independently. So, and now I'm in a wheelchair. So if I have to wait two more years, you know, where in life will I be? Like, will I be able to wait this long for a treatment that's on the markets but I can't afford?
So at the moment, there is no treatment.
No.
There's none. But is there something that may work that they're trialling that has potential for you?
Yeah, so there are a lot of drugs in the pipeline. There's a lot of research going on over in America. They have, of course, a higher incidence rate of ataxia. So it has a bit more attention over there.
Mm.
And there's a lot of research going into it, especially this one drug called Moxie. And, you know, while I am hopeful that that might become the treatment, I am kind of reluctant to put all my eggs in one basket.
Of course, and to say, this is it, this will solve all my problems. If we close our eyes and do a little bit of wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when, and this drug was something that could maybe halt progression of the mm-hmm. condition, when do you think that it would become available? And when it does become available, you don't want any of this campaign, you just want it.
Yeah, so it's in the final stages of clinical trials over in America at the moment. So it's looking like in the next year or so, Moxie could possibly become available.
And why do you think it would work for you?
And
for the other 200
I don't want to hold on to hope for like a cure-all magic medicine. I'm quite happy as I am right now, even though I do use a wheelchair and people might look at me like, oh, you know, that poor girl, her life must be so hard. But I don't really see it that way. I have a great life, and if I could find some treatment to like stop the progression at this very point, I would take that in a heartbeat.
And how have you gone about trying to talk to the HSC, trying to talk to government bodies to say, well, hang on a second now. If this is something that works for me, or if there's another one comes on, I don't want to be hanging around waiting for your approval. Have you done anything about that?
Yeah, so I've spoken to a lot of TDs. I've got meetings coming up after the Dáil recess with hopefully Stephen Donnelly and Richard Boyd-Barrett. So I'm very excited about that. And then I also wrote an article for the Irish Times that came out last week, and that kind of raised a lot of awareness. And then also the good graces of people with like radio shows and podcasts just letting me raise awareness of the issue.
Okay, and there's a lot to you. There is a lot to you because you're 22 and you've already... Have you written for the Financial Times?
I have.
What do you like? Go on, tell me. You wrote some articles. And one I thought was really interesting because it was about fashion. And you like your fashion.
I do.
And you will continue to like your fashion. So tell me, what was the theme of that article?
Yeah, so I was over in London last summer interning in the Financial Times, and I had a really amazing editor who just kind of mentored me and, you know, helped me get the ideas from my brain out onto a page. So
Tell him I need that.
I love fashion. So one of the first pieces I wrote was about accessible fashion and how, you know, I can't wear certain things like long coats or sleeves with flares on them because it might get caught.
It impedes, the movement.
Yeah.
And do you think then, if you look at catwalks and runways, we're looking at our Victoria's Secret models and they're all... But do you think that somebody like you in a wheelchair or somebody like me, who isn't the perfect size, whatever, you know, are we getting a little more representation, do you think?
I definitely think so. Yeah, I went to London Fashion Week earlier this year and I was writing it up for The Guardian. And I met a couple of models over there who are with... I can't think of the name, ZBD Management. So it's a modelling agency that caters towards differently abled people and people who don't look like the stereotypical 6 foot model. And I met some really amazing people and I can see that the industry is definitely taking a turn for the better.
Listen, we're going to go to Newark in a second, but I have some great music coming up in a little while. Will you stay around with me for a little bit of a chat? Is that all right? You are listening there to 22-year-old and already so wise, Niamhna Herbert. She's going to stay with us for a little while after the Newark Dinish Tosha and the Priestkill Nulta Lemihal O'Toole. There, all right. Now we are just chatting to Niamhna Herbert here, and Niamh is living with a rare disease called Friedreich. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Friedreich's ataxia.
Yes. And she's telling us about her ambition to secure treatment funding even before treatment has been found. But I'm very interested in your career ambitions. What are they, Niamh?
I'm not really sure at the moment. I think journalism is kind of the area into which I'm heading, but sure, I've still got 2 more years of college, so, you know.
And what are you studying in college?
I do history and theology in Trinity, so. Okay.
So with this condition, you are still enjoying lots of things.
Absolutely.
What do they say to you about the expectancy of it? You know, how is it going to affect you as the years approach?
Well, it's a progressive disease and the life expectancy is significantly lower than the average person, around like 30, late 30s to 40. But again, like the whole condition, it's all based on person to person. So whereas I... you know, could live a relatively short life. There are other people at FA who could live a long life or vice versa, like no one knows.
And so in terms of how does this inform you and how you live your life every day?
I suppose when I was younger, as in like 18 or 19, I kind of felt very pressured to like start a life and a career because I didn't know if I'd be able to in the future. So now I'm at the point where I'm 22 and I've accomplished like a few things I had in mind back then. So I'm like, oh, yeah, that's great.
Now I can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it is lovely to meet you. Will you keep us posted as to how your campaign is going?
Absolutely.
And keep everybody informed in terms of that drug and whether it, the clinical trials have worked.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll
yeah.
see. And we wish you the best of luck. And you're Perfect. Definitely an inspiration. And I know if you like fashion, you're definitely going to like music. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yes, you're
okay,
right.
OK, because Amy has joined us in the studio here. Would you like to have a listen to Amy and some of her songs?
Definitely, yes.
Definitely. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi, how's things?
OK, so, Amy, you've recently released your second single.
Yes.
Break Me.
Yeah.
And you have, on keyboards we have...
We have the lovely Jake.
OK.
And on guitar here we have Sam.
Okay, and you are gearing up for your debut headline show at Whelan's in November.
November,
you are
yeah.
very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your music.
Well, my name is Amy. This is always a hard question. I've been in absolute love with music since I was a kid. And only when I kind of got to my teenage years, I really started to kind of have the confidence to actually pursue it as a career. It was something I've always dreamed of doing, growing up watching Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera. And as a teenager, I started kind of doing YouTube videos and stuff like that, just get my name out there. And then I eventually started to release my own music that I wrote myself. And that's why I'm here today.
Isn't it wonderful to have two young women who are giving it their all in their different careers? Well, listen, take it away.
Thank you.
Is your current single. It's a playlist on the RT Radio 1 playlist. It's Break Me.
Thank you.
Let me paint a picture. Let everybody see it. So tired of hiding behind these walls is my truth. Tell me what's your perfect. Then tell me was it worth it. Got you thinking you deserve it. Let me lay it all out for you. I close my eyes and count to ten. It's alright, it's alright, it's alright. But it's alright. I got some baggage, but I'm not trying to hide it. So I throw my hands up, walk a little taller. Cause I know nothing, nothing is gonna break me. It's alright. I got some baggage, but I'm not trying to hide it. So the song ends up, walk a little too late. Cause I know nothing, nothing is gonna break me. It's alright. We've all got some baggage There's no point trying to hide it. So this song ends up, walk a little taller. Cause I know nothing, nothing is gonna break me. It's gonna break me. Woo, yeah, yeah. I'm gonna stand up. I'm gonna live free. I'm feeling stronger. You cannot break me. I'm gonna stand up. I'm gonna live free. I'm feeling stronger. You cannot break me.
Amy, look, you've got a full audience out there in the studio. They're all clapping. You are a firecracker. That is amazing. Beautiful song. You wrote it yourself?
Yeah, I wrote it with my really good friend, Richie McCourt. He's okay. Really talented.
Well, I'll tell you what. You're going to sing us another song before the end of the show. Yeah. Looking forward to it. Niamh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure meeting you. Keep us posted. We're going to take a break and we will be back with the gorgeous Victoria Smurfit.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yes, and it's Brenda here until 4:30. Simple text in, what a voice, exclamation mark. Aww. That's all. That's for Amy, and she will sing with us again at the end of the show, a lot in on weddings and hotels and voluntary contributions. And hi, Brenda, I stay in hotels a lot, 2 to 3 nights per week. How the hell can you make a cup of tea or coffee again after your knicker story? Shouldn't have read that out. Very inappropriate, said Joe. Sorry, Joe, I just wanted to warn you, actually. Voluntary contributions, my child's school only allocate lockers to students whose parents paid the voluntary contributions. Not good. Hi, Brenda. I'm listening from London and a teacher here. The kids we teach don't even buy a pen or pencil for their return, nor do they have any textbooks. We need to supply everything, and I mean everything. I was educated in the Irish education system and it's still hands down the best. Yes, it's expensive, but you pay for the best. Only 2 primary kids in the country. Anyway, there's loads of noisy neighbours and everything. But look, more importantly, she has moved back after living in LA for 8 years. Award-winning actress Victoria Smurfit has moved house. She's now here to talk about family, career and what is next. How are you, Victoria?
I'm great. You know, I feel like you've really lucked out and you got the right person singing.
I did.
I know, because, I mean, I'd have to pay you money to allow me to sing. It's desperate. Yeah. Amy, that was really
that
stunning.
That was lovely. Really, Amy, and she's going to give us a little song for the end as well. Tell me a little bit about yourself. You've moved back from LA and I know you were talking to Ray about potentially moving back. So when did it all happen? What's going on?
It's all happened pretty quickly, really. It was a sort of an idea in the back of my head towards the end of last summer, because you know, I was talking to, you know, the eye doctors that Evie deals with and timelines and all this kind of good stuff. And I just thought it was really important that we were closer to family. And a lot of my immediate family are in England. So is Doug's, the kid's dad. And it just made just ton more sense, you know. And after 8.5 years in Santa Monica, which was blissful and gorgeous and wonderful, we got to work a lot and we got to meet loads of fantastic people. It's just time to get back. And the kids feel Irish, so, you know, we're hops
close.
Yeah, you know, and they need to know their heritage and they need to be able to spend more time here and just be.
Isn't it hard at the moment? Your career was probably hopping over there in LA.
It was good.
Yeah, it was good. And you suddenly go, okay, I'll take a little step backwards now, because obviously, you know, Evie needs you more. Your children need you. But we do these things, don't we?
You do. You do. You're way, as you know, we always say we're way down the call sheet of life. But, you know, happily. And they're already so much more sort of relaxed and happy. So it's really nice. It's a bit like, you know, there's sort of a low grade with the things that they have to learn in the schools there, such as lockdown drills and earthquake drills and all the stuff that we can't get our head around because we grew up here. And, you know, that would be really jarring. But, you know, it's just what the kids got on with. But now they're not having to worry about it. And, you know, it's really taking the pressure off them.
What was this? Were they in the school when one of the shootings took place?
My girls were. Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't, thank God. Yeah. It wasn't a shooting in the girls' school, but there was a there was a real lockdown where a disgruntled student had decided to come over with daddy's gun and threaten everybody. But the school, you know, the school were so brilliant. They locked it down. They protected everybody. But, you know, you've still got 2 hours where your kids are hiding under a desk wondering what on earth's going on. And you as a parent racing home trying to think. But it's not why we moved. But it was certainly when push comes to shove, you know, I feel like LA was telling us get out between that and then 2 earthquakes. I'm like, okay, I hear you. We're leaving. We're gone. It's worked out for the better.
Now, I didn't see your Late Late Show appearance, so I looked it up last night.
Oh, did you?
I was totally blown away by your daughter, Evie, and when she spoke about macular dystrophy.
Yeah.
She's amazing. How is she now? And can you tell us a little bit about it?
She's incredible, you know, she really is. And all three of them are, because Ridley and Flynn really do an awful lot of backup work for her and support her very much. And Eve, she's wanted to be really open about it because it's sort of it's the empowerment element of it, isn't it? You know, A, knowledge is power, and B, if she was... You know, Fighting Blindness came and talked to me and said, would you be an ambassador for us? I said, well, it's not my story, it's Eve's. So I spoke to Eve and she really wanted to do it because she felt like there was nowhere she could, no one she could talk to straight off the bat in the magical world of Google, of someone her age going through being a teenager and schools and boys and, oh, by the way, macular dystrophy.
Your own kids out there, don't you? Yeah.
But
yeah.
Because she wants to do it, yeah. No, and when we walked around the flats at the Late Late and I didn't know how it was going to play out because you just don't. And good Lord, that girl, she threw a hip, flicked her hair and she sat down and she commanded the stage. She was funny. She was smart. She was clear. She was honest. I was so proud.
Of course you were.
I was so proud.
And how is she now? How is her condition? How is she feeling?
She's, she's feeling better after I took her to Switzerland to see another doc there. We've seen a lot of the incredible doctors here, Dr. Keegan, we've seen Dr. Gorin in UCLA, we've seen all the top guys, and it's such a tight community of strong, supportive people who are aware that we don't have an answer, but we're en route. And the more we kick and scream and punch and fight and ask for support and ask for funding and ask for research, the easier it's going to get because, you know, there are more than enough people with Stargardt's that it should have a cure. But there's not so many that it's the first place people are investing. And you know, we when we were in Switzerland, because I sort of want all the top guys to know Evie, so that when something comes along, they go, oh, that Evie Baxter creature,
yes,
that
let's
I saw.
Try, yeah,
that's, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm sort of being the squeaky wheel, so she feels a lot better because we saw this guy and he said he was talking about her peripherals are always going to be all right, and now it's a race against time of keeping her because the retinal cells die every day and. She was hilarious because she said to me, she goes, Mom, do you mean knowing the doctor said that I have to stay out of the bright light and wear my sunglasses all the time? First, I'm going to be a total rock star. And secondly, thank God we left LA. There's no bright light in England.
Yeah, she's a great sense of humor. She's a lovely little
twist. She's an absolute cracker.
Yeah, and then I suppose as a mom, you're managing that and then there's 2 other children and everybody wants a piece of you.
They do.
Do you find that? Yeah.
Absolutely, they do. Mm. And they're right too.
Sorry, I might be projecting my issues on
you. No, listen, I hear you, and it's true. And but they should want a piece of you. Mm. I mean, my cunning plan is mid-September to come over with the 3 of them and go to the Longines Irish Champions.
You are here,
and bring them and show them not only home but the best of home with the best horse races, with the best jockeys, with the best style. Oh, Evie's going to be
tell
all
me about
over
the
style.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's the incredible weekend, the 14th, 15th of September, you know, and it's sponsored by Longines, who, you know, traditionally have always had this incredible elegance and they've always been connected to the equestrian world. And do you know what my favourite thing about it is, though? On the Sunday. So Saturday's at Leopardstown. Kids go free. My kids are going free.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Bring your kids.
Yeah,
free.
Definitely.
Yeah,
yeah.
We all love free.
Yeah.
So on Leopardstown on the Saturday, so it's going to be a real family event as well as at the Curragh on Sunday. But on the Sunday, we're bringing the legends out of retirement, and Charlie Swan and Johnny Murtagh and all are all going to be racing for charity.
Is this in the Curragh?
Yeah, the Curragh, yeah.
Okay, great.
Which I haven't seen. Have you seen it?
I have seen it. I'm from the Curragh.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yes,
is it gorgeous?
Born,
everybody
it
says
gorgeous.
It's fabulous.
Gorgeous.
Dying to see
You'll
it.
You'll have a great time.
I'm sure.
But how are you going to fit in your career? What are we doing? As I said, it was thriving in LA. You've moved to the UK.
Yeah.
Do you find it harder to get work? Is there anything coming up? What are you up to?
Well, I've been taking my foot off the gas acting wise for some of this year, so that I can, you know, sort out kids, family life,
yeah,
and
yeah,
moves and change
all
and all that.
Yeah.
So while I've been doing that, I'm in development with a drama over here, well, in the UK, and a reality show in the US, and so. Because that's great, because you can do that from home. You can do that, you know, waiting for them, pick them up at school or whatever. And then come September, if everything goes according to plan and they like their school and they're happy, and I can get back out on the circuit.
And yeah, because we'd hate to not have you on screen.
Oh, bless you.
And I'm sure, particularly, I can see in a real gritty drama, something on the BBC.
Oh, sort
something
that
like that.
Go
can
on.
You see that?
Yeah, oh, I can see that. I fully can see that.
And tell me, was it difficult making the move from LA over here, or did everybody just slot straight in?
You know what it's like when you make a decision that's the right one, it just happens kind of.
Yeah.
It's not easy, because moving house is up there with death and divorce for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough, but yeah, at the same token, it sort of unpicked itself easily enough that we all knew it was the right decision.
And I hate to be nosy.
Oh, be nosy.
Oh, go on.
Go on.
How's the love life? You don't have to answer that.
Answering
but we can
those
check
questions
it out
without a glass of wine and a pub, I just don't understand. I'm very happy.
You're very happy.
I'm
oh,
very
good.
Happy.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
You enjoyed Amy singing.
Oh my God, gorgeous.
Amy, will you guys get just in place again? Because we want to finish up on a song. So, Victoria, you launched the Irish Champions Weekend, which takes place in Leopardstown, Saturday the 14th, and at the Curra on
Sunday the 15th.
Of September.
Yes.
Yes. And more information at irishchampionsweekend.ie. What have you got in development, by the way?
Well, I've got a drama and a reality show, but
what's the reality show?
I can't tell you yet. No, I'll come back and tell you when I can. I will, I promise. But you know, there's great prizes for the most elegant ladies, so you and I need to pull it out of the
we
hat.
We could definitely pull it out. Yeah. I'll talk to you.
I know. Listen, there's going to be watches and Mary and hotels and prizes and things. I think you and I should go head to head. Should
we
do it?
Here. Listen,
oh, we get Amy. If Amy
no
sings behind us as we're walking in, we'll be fine.
There is absolutely no competition.
Could be a trio.
Yeah. Will you pass on our best to all your children, but Evie, because she made such an impact when she was on The Late Late. And I mean, just looking at it last night, I was blown away by her lovely sense of self, and she's so articulate.
She is.
And such a beautiful looking young lady. Oh. So will you pass on our best?
I will.
That we all wish her really, really well.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Sparford, give her a clap. Amy, what are you going to sing us out with?
I'm going to sing a cover of Alicia Keys' Fallen.
Oh,
wow. I'm going
you'll
to
have some tears, right? Can somebody get the tissues? And just to remind you that Amy's single is Break Me is out now, and her headline show will be in Whelan's on November the 24th. Amy is going to sing us out now with Alicia Keys and Fallen. Take it away, Jake and Sam on keyboards and guitar.
I keep on falling in and out of love with you. Sometimes I love you, sometimes you make me blue. Sometimes I feel good, at times I feel used. Loving you, darling, makes me so confused. I keep on falling in and out of love with you. I never loved someone the way that I this way. How do you more than what a fool. Oh, baby.